from the floor. I suppose one thing I had in the back of my mind, and I think that Ricardo and the other organisers of the festival, we tend to think of Bimmy as being like a little laboratory where we can test out different possibilities. And I suppose one of the things that we were thinking about in terms of this rediscovering of Esther Schub, that we didn't think it could all be done in one day. And I just wondered what you felt would be the necessary steps if one were to make a kind of concerted effort to bring Schub into proper focus. I mean, whether that would be on the level of restoration of prints, finding prints, whether there would be publications of original material documents or vital things like that. I just wonder whether that might be one way of launching the discussion. Is it something that you feel maybe, you know, maybe Graham, you went back, you began the day by saying you were grateful we invited you in the sense that it kind of obliged you to re-engage with the whole episode of your life and also your life as a researcher and so forth. I mean, I say this from a position of ignorance. It is just maybe a too simplistic a question, but I just wondered, having sort of the discussions today and the films today, what would be the, do you think there would be a possible project that could grow out of that in terms of bringing Schub into clearer focus? And how would one go about doing that?
Okay.
Maybe
just all of those things in one answer.
How would one go about doing
it?
Maybe
just all of those things in one answer.
Yeah,
2 minutes. Right, okay. Again, thank you. It's just great to see that stuff on the big screen again. It's great to see Gasher there. I haven't seen that in 20 years. I think the answer is we need to get in close up, which is the original biography plus the collected articles, translated and with commentary, and put somewhere online. When I was thinking about doing this 20 years ago, it was going to be a book. There wasn't a huge audience for it, so economically it didn't make as much sense as Man with a Movie Camera for obvious reasons.
Mm-hmm.
As an online repository, obviously that's a lot cheaper to do, quicker to do, and more people can access it. The films all need to be in one place, and again, an online repository would be the answer. I know I can see Fyodor Romanov's whenever I want. I know the great ways in the Imperial War Museum if I want to go down there. It's great I've been able to see two films I haven't seen for ages. I'd love to see Strana Sovyetov again, because it was such a, when I was in the Soviet Union watching, Strana Sovyetov is very much largely Fall of the Romanovs and the Great Way, only changed for a 1937 audience, not a 1927 audience. Obviously Trotsky's out and the story changes. To be able to have those two online somewhere. You know, yesterday when we were looking at SA films, where what is neorealism? And you could see if it was a neorealist film, it would look like this. If it was an Hollywood film, it would look like that. It would be great to be able to do a split screen of The Great Way and Land of the Soviets and just run them next to each other and see how Esfir changed it from 27 to 37. Beyond the obvious Trotsky has to go, there's a lot of other stuff about nuances and the way stories are told. So I'd say an online archive. I did do it in 3 minutes, yeah.
Yeah. I can't add anything to that. The films, restoration of the films, translation of her autobiography and other writings. Online archive, yeah.
I'd like to ask a question from everybody. Who has seen Dziga Vertov's Enthusiasm and remembers it? Not bad. Well, if you've seen it, I suppose you remember that a lot that is in Kshe, admittedly Schub's best film, I think, comes directly from Enthusiasm, when not from A Man with a Movie Camera. So I think it would be interesting not to oppose those two names. The authorial, the value of signature for me has been established in the case of Schub and in the case of Vertov, but try and get the feel of what it was to be making documentaries in the Soviet Union at the time. There are a lot of important documentary directors to discover. You have a lot whom you know because they have made fiction films, Medvedkin, Kuleshov, Pudovkin. You have a lot who are completely unknown. I mentioned Vladimir Erofeyev, but there are Poselsky, Jakob Bliok, and so on and so forth. There are a lot of women documentary directors, Svilova, Lydia Stepanova, not Rodchenko's wife, but Lydia Stepanova, fiction women director also. And if we don't get the whole context, we'll always be stuck with the idea Shub is great, Vertov is great, and that's it. And to me, this is completely fake. To me, what I've seen here and what I've seen five Shub films again preparing for this conference, is Shub seems to me to be one of the most conformist politically of the documentary film directors. She always applies strictly the slogans of the party instead of developing her own discourse, which is why she remained always, I've seen you. Yes, Michael has seen you now. And so that's interesting. One might wonder why. And the others have been sometimes less interesting, more interesting. But if we don't get the context, we won't get anything. We will remain stuck with this idea of great directors and nothing around them, which is a feeling that I've had in many moments at this conference. Well, that's it.
My question concerns, rediscovering as for Shub, Bernhard, you mentioned it somehow already that a question would be putting Shub into context and putting her into the historical context, perhaps not only of her fellow directors and her fellow pioneers, but also the context of the time. So what changed from her avant-gardist time to her Stalinist times? Why we feel that her avant-gardism somehow failed, and perhaps today is her first great failure in that sense. So in a way, staging the future of the Soviet Union in a much more, one would say, conservative way than she deals with the American material, which makes the film today looking a bit strange, or her message gets turned around. And I thought one of the hurdles for rediscovering her is how we deal with the contradictions in her work of anonymity as a director, of a former avant-gardist who became consonant with the political party line, of the first director who had an idea of the historical ontology of the moving image but then loses it. And my question would be, how can we address these contradictions in her work whilst rediscovering it?
I think the answer is to contextualise it. I think you're right. We need to see the other film directors as well. We need to see Erofeyev. I watched quite a lot of Erofeyev when I was in the Soviet Union. Yes. And went, this is really interesting. And you can see why he got into a lot of trouble as well. But I think we need to get the Shub stuff done, there, available as a kind of first step. But to make any real sense of it, of course, we're going to need to look at all the other stuff that was made at the time. Yeah, you can't decide Hitchcock's a genius if you don't see any film ever made in the United States of America. Yeah, we do have to do that.
I think that there's also that wider point, and to be because I agree with the online archive and more films and more stuff, but to be heretical in the context of BIMI, I want to return to that notion of the fact. What are these facts, and how do they relate to what we can understand about what the Soviet Union was through that period, as you said, the changes that are occurring. I mean, it fascinates me how Stalin is not really present visually. I mean, there's the occasional mention of him, but what makes this a Stalinist or Stalinized version of reality? How do we set this all, amidst the broader historical and political struggles of the time? So it's not just about rediscovering a filmmaker and a filmmaker's vision, but still thinking about the way in which film is a document and what sort of a document of what sort of times is it. So using it as historical material as well is important.
I don't think it is Stalinist, because I think that part of the historical part of the context that needs to be recovered is also the broader historical context in which, you know, the early 1930s, the Soviet Union had a completely different position in relation to in relation to what we would now call a global perspective. I mean, the situation immediately after the Wall Street crash and going into the 30s, when there's this constant question that gets asked as to why didn't people who came back from visiting the Soviet Union in the 30s, came back to the United States or to Britain or to Western Europe or whatever, why didn't they see what was going on? Why didn't they see this, you know, what we now simply encompass as the rise of Stalinism and so on and so forth? I mean, I was completely convinced by one of the interviewees in the film that I made that uses this was Eric Hobsbawm. And Hobsbawm was quite clear about this, because one of the problematics that I was dealing with was the fact that that Troen left the Soviet Union, never went back after the early 30s except once, and was very depressed by what he'd seen going on in the Prompt Party trial, in the rise of Stalinism, and found that he couldn't talk about it to people back in the United States. However, they didn't want to know, because at that point the Soviet Union stood as the counterexample to what was happening to capitalism and the Depression, yeah, because Dniprostroy was the biggest hydroelectric project, and as I'm reminded watching this again, apparently the cheapest in the world at that time. The Donbas was becoming, you know, operative and extremely productive. The Soviet Union was, as Hobsbawm put it, forging ahead as everybody saw it. And so that has to be counted into the historical perspective as well. And for that reason, I don't think that Shub's work, and certainly not this film, but today either, I don't think that they should be counted as Stalinist. They were the orthodox, yes, but the orthodoxy was, I'm reasonably convinced that that was the language that Komsomol and so on and so forth spoke, because for them, it was a hopeful time still.
But how do you deal with things like liquidating the Kulaks in that context? If you're talking about the reality of the Soviet Union in the 1930s compared with the general perspective you're talking about, in which the Soviet Union represents the counterbalance to America, which are you talking about? Are you talking about how it was perceived by people like Eric Hobsbawm or people of earlier vintage than him, or by the people who did report on, say, the famine in the Ukraine? It wasn't totally unknown.
It wasn't totally unknown, but then you have to look at, I suppose you would have to look at, I mean, I'm kind of speculating, right, because I'm not a specialist in the period, but you would have to look at the sources of the information that was coming out, right? So some of the General Electric people, one of the General Electric people, for example, wrote a book about his experiences, which was published at around the same time as this film. But it still only skates the surface. I know about that because we researched it, because we, you know, I don't want to go into the whole complex story, but the point is that it would be the same thing if you asked about, there isn't an unequivocal answer if you ask about what did people in the United States, Britain, whatever, know about the way that the Nazis were treating the Jews already at that period, not just later. Some people knew, some didn't. Some admitted, some didn't. And if you don't admit that ambivalence into your recounting of the history, then I think
I agree that there was less known about the Soviet Union. I'm not saying that everybody knew, but there had been reportage throughout the 1920s of what the Soviet secret police had been up to. It was not a surprise to people that there was murder and incarceration on a massive scale. That was all out there, but not on... I don't say that it was as known as it is now, that's all. But although, yes, in certain places it was regarded as a counterbalance to the US, you have to look at the other side of the balance sheet, I think, if we're talking about historical context. And I don't know if the historical context... I think these films survive despite that, would be my perspective on it, that they do have aesthetic value, despite that they do, you know, follow a Stalinist party line on the whole about matters such as the kulaks. But
any questions?
Oh, don't worry about that. That's fine. It was just to add to that discussion that I think a very important element of the context, which does often get tend to get overlooked, is the fact that in the early 1930s, many historians now accept that the Soviet Union, in spite of our image of Stalin as the rigid leader who was directing a plan that worked in every respect, was a country that was in absolute turmoil, and it was in chaos. Moshe Lewin in the late 70s referred to it as a quicksand society, and I think the liquidation of the kulaks, people were disappearing, other people were getting promoted way above their competence, above their heads. And I think this is a vital part of the context which might help us to make sense of one or two contradictions, which might help us to flesh out our ideas about what is and isn't known, I guess. I mean, I think people possibly didn't see when they came back from Russia what was going on because there was so much to see and they really weren't sure quite what was going on. And I think it's important that we hold on to that. It's just a very brief intervention rather than a question, I'm afraid, inspired by what you just heard.
Well, the whole period from 2028 to, let's say, Kirov's, even after Kirov's assassination, until the Great Show Trials, 36, 37, 38, is a period of extreme change, extremely rapid change, in which it's difficult to know which way it's going in the first place. In the late 20s, you have this cultural revolution promoted by the proletarian movements, which Stalin puts an end to in 32, which is ambiguous because the ending this cultural revolution is at the same time completely welcome by everybody, and at the same time it's obviously a way of better controlling what is happening. Then you have this breathing space between 32, the April 32 decree, and Kirov's assassination in 34, etc., etc. So the move, the politics, the everyday politics, what people live through on an everyday basis changes very quickly until the Great Terror, what has been called the Great Terror, not completely falsely, but it is something that changes on the cultural level. It changes enormously, and I think the early 30s are one of the most lively period in Soviet cinema. I think you have it's as good as the avant-garde of the late 20s, from 30 to 35, and even to 38, you have some extraordinary films which are not isolated. Of course, we see them from that perspective now. A lot of them were not released or were banned, or etc. But even so, they existed, they went into production, etc. So this part of Soviet history and Soviet cultural history has been studied, of course, but in very specialized volumes. And it's difficult to get a grasp of it. Personally, I've always tried to do it. I'm not a historian, period. I'm a film historian, I hope so. And I've tried to do it. I've tried to grasp it through films. which has been extremely fruitful, in my opinion, for what I've felt, for what I've found. But each one has to go about it. And obviously, it's a terrain that has not been fully explored. It's still a matter for a subject for further research. And Stalinist, of course, is a bad label. It doesn't work on anything. I was just thinking when you were saying this is not a Stalinist movie or this is a Stalinist movie. I was thinking today, for instance, works on a completely binary principle, which is they and us, yesterday and today, the have-nots, etc. Which I think is binary, is simplistic, and. Which is not the case of this film, but this film was, of course, a very special situation. As you said, the situation of the Americans helping is something, I suppose, the film was not shown 2 years later, because the situation had changed. It was incredible to show those Americans bathing in Armenia or in the Donbass. And
well, that's what I assume, that the film disappeared because it showed things which were not convenient.
But the other films function always on this binary, on this binary level, which I think is quite simplistic and does not work. A lot of that was a cliche of the time. I mean, a lot of film, Moskva Sovetskaya by Jim Chuzny, another documentary which you may have seen, is also yesterday, old Moscow, the marketplace. Today, the new, what we've seen in this splendid second reel of today, the new Moscow with the architectural avant-garde experiments all over the place. And you have that in all those films, in the film that we were mentioning, the film by Chervyakov, the fiction film that we are mentioning by Chervyakov, Years and People, is also one of those films. You have, we are the good ones, and the others are just to be completely rejected. This was one of the cliches of these late 20s, and I'm always sorry when I see it come up. And Eisenstein is not immune to that. Certainly
that
not.
The older one, yeah,
certainly yeah. Not in general. In the general line, is the old and the new, and you have, and the attacks on the kulaks are even more caricatured. Then, well, here you don't see any kulaks, but in Eisenstein you have the caricature, which was, as we know, Eisenstein's strong point, which are really mean and totally unpolitical. They're just Eisenstein having his fun with caricatures. So all of this has to be probed further, perhaps lowering the frontiers between fiction and non-fiction. At the time where Novi Lev was advocating pure documentary, condemning the use of an actor or a model, to use Bresson's words, to play the part of Lenin, at the same time, members of Novi Lev were working in films which were combination fiction and documentary films. Cem Chuzny did Opium, which is a totally mixed fiction non-fiction film. Oleg Freilich, an actor, made Prostitutka, a film about prostitution. The first part is a story about prostitution. The second part is statistics and documentary material, compilation material about prostitution. And who was the author of the title? Viktor Shklovsky. So all those people were working in all possible directions, and they were not as straightforward as we may get the impression by just reading what's been published. What's been published, let's say, in a very good compilation, in a very, very good collection such as the Film Factory. In the first place, I think Film Factory should be complemented by the book about Bertov by Yuri Tsivian, Lines of Resistance, which is an anthology of writings not by Vertov, but around Vertov. With two of them already, we would have a binary attitude also. Anyway,
sorry. So I think in a way, I mean, what's interesting is these moments when Schubert undercuts any kind of binary. I mean, that's what gives the film intelligence. So when you've got the American speaking and being translated and acknowledging that you will interpret this, you know, taking on different sort of subject positions, or, you know, in the women film script, you know, that fluidity of movement between the fictional and the stage and the played, and you know, she is bringing these things to light, so there isn't just a simple kind of adherence to this is the fact, this is the truth, you know, that there's a laying of it out there, which I think is what holds some of the interest, what, you know, elevates it.
I agree.
Hey, can I come in there? Just, I suppose, taking up that point of the binary, I mean, obviously there's the... I wonder how self-aware you think that she was, because, you know, when she puts in that shot of the penguins, it's so over the top and obvious, and she's, you know, making the joke that it seems she knows that she's making that binary and, you know, making them out to be something else. But also it becomes, I mean, in the end it is a piece that seems to be, I don't know if it was shown or not in America, but she's looking for, like, workers to unite worldwide, so it's not just for USSR audience. Sorry, there's two questions in there. So the first being, how self-aware was she? And the second one was, what audience did she intend it for? Did she intend it for an international audience?
I didn't hear the second question.
The second question was she showing, or was she making efforts to get that today shown to workers around the world? Or was it for a Soviet audience?
Actually, well, just this point first. Today was a co-production with Weltfilm, which was a subsidiary of the German Communist Party. So it was, in the first place, it was a Soviet-German co-production. In the second place, it was Schub's first film to be shown outside of the Soviet Union. Paradoxically, Jay later pointed out that paradoxically, those first three films, the famous trilogy by Schub, was not shown abroad before she died, which is very strange. And so this was the first, but as you pointed out, it was banned in the States. It was, of course, a big success in Germany, but censored, as you see. How aware was she? I don't know, but obviously at that time, metaphor or comparison was a big thing in Soviet cinema. Remember October, and using the shot of the penguins was really a little wink compared to what Eisenstein was doing with metaphors, as Yuri Tsivian put it, Kerensky, there's a rooster, there's a silver rooster at Kerensky, and as Yuri Tsivian put it, at some point Kerensky is entering the rooster's ass, as proven by Yuri Tsivian by a very shot-by-shot description of the sequence. So that was just probably a wink to a trend of the time, I would say. But she uses very little metaphor. Actually, this thing of using film proper to compare things, the materiality of film, not yesterday and today, not the idea, but the quality of film is very rare with her. And I was interested to see that she was planning in the women project, that she was planning to include fiction films of the pre-revolutionary era, which is interesting because she should have done, actually, everything should have led her to do that, and she didn't in any of her realized project. And actually, I don't think this was made. I don't think fiction films were used as fiction films before Nicole Vedres' Paris 1900 in 1947-48. Of course, fiction films were used as documentary evidence in the Huawei Fight series by Capra, Litvak, and so on and so forth. But they never said they were fiction. And it's highly interesting to think that this woman who had edited so many fiction films, re-edited so many fiction films, at that late, comparatively late point, discovered the revealing quality of fiction as a document of contemporary or past life.
I had an another question concerning her audiences and the question of the archive, because I remember the discussion with around the Kinematographia Facta, so the cinema of the fact, and Schupp's position in that, Tretiakov's position in that as a productivist and operative author propagating the literature of fact. And I remember that there was the question of the audience is also posed by the formalists and Shklovsky, who are the audiences? And her position seemed to be that her audiences are future audiences. That also sometimes explains the strange pastness of the images she uses, and why she rather compiles them than shoots them, and why her films have such an historical character. But especially in the 30s, sometimes my suspicion is since these audiences vanished, she did the film for the archives. And so my question is, again, for rediscovering Schupp, since we are these audiences and find her films in the archives, she stored them. So could this be part of rediscovering her?
Yeah, I think so. I think it's a point well made. In her writing, there is definitely a flavour of I am doing this for posterity.
Mm.
There's a lot of stuff in there about, you know, we must go forward and build the socialist and all the blah, 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 blah. Quite often that seems to ring a false tone to me. I think it's just you're supposed to put that in. But certainly in the autobiography, there's a flavour of I'm doing this for the future. So that would help us with the project as well. Just need to find the right quote.
But in 1927, film archives and cinematics hadn't been invented yet.
No, there were
there. No, there were archives.
So she wasn't making films in 1927 before the cinematic of 2000 and whatever.
No, she wasn't.
That was an ambition. That's my point.
Well, the idea of future archive was always there.
Yeah.
But you're right. Also, she was very much attacked in post Soviet years in the 90s. A lot of people told me, well, I don't want to hear about Schupp because she cut the original material, she cut the original negative, the original stuff, and threw it away, or just dismembered it, which she denies. She always says she made dupes of everything instead of just cutting in the original, but I know that Soviet archives were doing that all the time until the late 60s, certainly. I know that I've seen certain early Vertov documentaries which had been cut by, thematically cut, so you had shots, archival shot of Patini, real archival shots of an aerial demonstration, and other shots, and instead of having the Vertov cutting, you had every shot by theme. So if you wanted to use it yourself for a compilation film, you could. But if you wanted to see the original Vertov film, you couldn't. So what Schupp has been blamed for was actually common practice, alas. And we meant so for long.
I think Consuelo, you wanted to ask a question?
Yes, only because I was astonished by the fact that some workers talk about mistakes and problems. So we feel that something bad happened sometimes. And I was astonished by that because we never, we don't feel that in Vertov's film, for instance. So I'd like you to know.
Oh, well, you do in Vertov. You see alcoholism, you see beggars, you see a lot of things that are completely far from the image, from the admitted image of the Soviet Union. But have you seen Medvedkin's documentary films? You should see Medvedkin's.
No, only by Marker.
No. But you have clips of them. You have revealing clips of them, significant clips of them in the Marker film. But you should see those. Yeah, they're available on DVD on a double bill of Marker's Last Bolshevik and Happiness, plus you have certain of his documentary, and they're absolutely devastating as to the state of the country. And the state of the industry and the state of bureaucracy.
Okay. No, yes, of course. But in this film, those kind is not it's normal, because she could cut that kind of.
My guess is that we're being reminded that that kind of criticism was part of the political mood. Mm. You want to become a Stakhanovite worker, you've got to admit to your mistakes.
And the secret of
people's
mistakes.
The worker must have to self-criticism or something, so it's a whole sort of...
Because part of that atmosphere... In you know, this early period, and I think you can see the same thing in Cuba in the 1960s, right? I mean, you've got to identify the period. Is that the discussion, critical elements in the discussion are part of the revolutionary process in that moment of, you know, enthusiasm and euphoria, which pushes the development of those revolutions in the first periods. Yeah, I think that if you imagine that such criticism couldn't be made, then that also is a distorted picture. Yeah, the question is, where were the limits? When were they imposed? Right. But to me, what the Shub film here shows is that yes, that was part of the discourse at that time. So why shouldn't she show it? In exactly the same way that everybody knew that the Americans were there. So why shouldn't she show them? Right? You know, but Berner's just talked about, you know, those changing stages in the 30s. And that's when, I mean, it seems to me that is when the censorship grows, when a more one-dimensional thinking grows. But it also seems to me that we're mistaken if we think that Stalin had achieved absolute power, earlier than whenever it was, than the mid-30s, I guess, right? But it's beginning, right? It's beginning in the early 30s because there is this forgotten history also that I was pointing to of the very first show trials. And the fact that the very first show trials didn't produce the same kind of brutality in terms of results. Yeah, people got sent to Siberia, but some of them got rehabilitated, and nobody was immediately beheaded, as it were. Right. So I think we have to see that an evolution in the political culture, in the middle of which Shub is working.
Can I just say this will have to be the last question because I've just been told we have to be out pretty quickly.
It's rather a commentary because this admission of my mistake was or my mistake is really one of these canonical forms and a good example of the contradictions, because most of the avant-gardists started to use the my mistake was form to keep the memory of the avant-garde.
Yeah, yeah.
So the memory of Shub that started with my mistake was, it was our own mistake, the mistake was, is a retelling of the story of the avant-garde and keeping the memory. So most of the avant-gardists admitted much more mistakes than they really did just to keep the memory.
That's very true.
And and this helps to read her films and her statements. However, it is an extremely contradictory form to keep the memory by declaring it a mistake.
There was a feel. It's certainly that is certainly true. But at the same time, there was a feel that an enormous lot had been achieved. There had been a revolution. There had been a liberation, specifically of women, of the Jews. Even if that did not last over 15 years, but there had been this revolution had taken place. There had been a revolution, a liberation in the arts, and by the early 30s, by the end of the proletarian groups, between 32-34, there was a feel with the filmmakers, to return to the filmmakers, that they had to find something else. Trauberg told me when the director of New Babylon told me that it was not, they were not coerced into praising socialist realism. It was something they were looking for. Something they certainly didn't know what it was going to be, but they tried to do something else. And as you know, the first film that they did that was considered a realist socialist masterpiece, the first of the Ivan trilogy, Maxim's trilogy, the use of Maxim, was called The Use of Maxim, and the second was called The Return of Maxim, as a tribute to Fantomas, not as a tribute to the arch-revolutionary Maxim, the hero of the trilogy. So those things were not as one-sided.
Okay, we do actually have to call things to a close, because I've been informed there is actually another screening starting at 6 o'clock. So we can certainly carry on the conversation, you know, elsewhere, and hopefully return to this through other events. I mean, for me, as I said at the beginning, the idea of doing today was really just a beginning for maybe further exploration. But could we just say thank you to the four contributors.